Hello, and welcome back to our next episode in the Dive and Dig News Podcast, where we bring you the latest in the field of maritime archaeology. I'm Dr. Lucy Blue, and I represent the Honor Frost Foundation that supports maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. This week, I am talking to a colleague, Dr. Steve Sidebotham from the University of Delaware, who works at the fascinating port site of Berenike on the Red Sea coast of Egypt. Steve has worked at Berenike forever, and it's a site that always has incredible stories to tell, but recent years have revealed even more extraordinary finds. Here is Steve to tell us more. The news from Berenike, your site on the Red Sea coast of Egypt, is quite exciting, I believe. Tell us a little bit about, was it the winter season this year where you made some fairly spectacular discoveries?
It was actually, it was winter 2022, so it was the winter before this last one. And we found, which was a huge surprise, we found fragments of the famous marble Buddha head that I think has been in the news a lot lately. And right next to it, we also found an inscription in Sanskrit, actually written in Brahmi script, but Sanskrit language. And at first we thought the two might have gone together, but in fact they don't. Our art historian tells us that the Buddha head actually dates to sometime between 90 and 140 AD, whereas the inscription itself dates, we now have a fairly firm date, to September 248 AD.
So that's a lot later.
Yeah, they're separated in time by obviously at least a century if the dating of the Buddha head is correct. And of course, the interesting thing about the head is it came in fragments, is when we found it, we said, well, where's the body? And then we thought back, we said, well, we found something like this that might be a body back in 2018 in an area immediately above and a little bit to the west. So we put the two together photographically. We couldn't do it physically because the body was sitting in Guft in the storage rooms there, and they fit.
Okay, I think we need to just rewind a little bit, because this is an amazing discovery, and it's amazing not but just because it's a Buddha and you're managing to put, which is, you know, remarkable in its own right, but it's amazing because Berenike isn't in India. In fact, it's a very long way from India. It's on the Red Sea coast of Egypt. So, and it's specifically in a temple, if I'm correct. So could you just tell us a little bit more about where this Buddha was found and the significance of that find in relation to the temple and the site more generally?
Sure. So by the way, it wasn't the first Buddha we've ever found at the site. That's the other thing the news media don't get. So it's the third Buddha we've had from the site.
Wow. Prolific Buddha site.
In fact, after we found this marble head in 2022, any sculpture that came up immediately, people were identifying, is it a Buddha? And then the other thing that people don't talk about is that we also had a stela that we found had three Hindu deities carved on it. And that came from a little room adjacent to and abutting the southern exterior wall of the temple itself. And that's the same little room from which the small Buddha head also came. And that's the same room where we also found some teak heads of Serapis and a whole bunch of other things. It clearly seems to have been a repository where in which sometime in the late period, and by that I mean the 4th or the 5th centuries, somebody took a number of items that had been stored in the temple or displayed in the temple and put them here, either for safekeeping or because they were running out of room in the temple and needed to have room for newer dedications, which wasn't unusual. As you know, ancient temples often had these called bothros in the singular, these, if you will, sacred trash dumps into which they would deposit earlier material. So we know that the temple in its current manifestation was built sometime during the reign of Tiberius. We have dozens of inscriptions from the entrance, from the portico, and from the courtyard. that show us activity here, at least epigraphic activity, through the early 4th century. So the latest actual dated inscription we have is Tetrarchic, dates to around 305. And then, of course, we have plenty of archaeological evidence, you know, in the form of pottery especially, that the temple was operating probably as a temple into the 5th century. We just this season, and that is 2023, we found trash dumps on both sides of the temple, abutting it, right against it. Yeah. And that suggests that there were activities in the temple area into the 6th century. But of course, whether those activities were religious or simply people living there, squatting there, doing whatever they were doing and throwing their trash next to it, that we don't know. But probably at that point, the temple wasn't functioning as a religious building anymore. It was just a place where squatters, you know, did their thing.
So do you know, to whom the temple was dedicated? Do we have any sense of...
Oh, absolutely. The inscriptions are very clear. It was to Isis, with a huge secondary dedication to Serapis. We have, at this point, between heads of Serapis and, you know, the feet that were his image, we have well over a dozen images of Serapis, although interestingly no inscriptions. And then we've had a number of sculptural finds of other deities, both Egyptian, your standard Egyptian ones with Horus and Osiris, and of course Isis, Serapis I've just mentioned, and some of your standard Greco-Roman ones. So we certainly have Artemis and Neptune, a few others. And then very interestingly, outside of the Hindu deities that I mentioned and Buddha, we also have images of two Meroitic deities. Sebu Mekhair, which we found fragments of a large, I suppose you can call it life-size, statue and stone of Sebu Mekhair at the front of the temple. And then in that little room, the little repository I was telling you about, where we found the stela of the Hindu gods and the small Buddha head, we found a little tiny bronze statuette really, of another Meroitic deity. And it may well be that two of the Greek texts refer to some Meroitic kings, although we can't be completely sure about that yet. So that's...
But this is amazing, isn't it, really? I mean, I having worked in the region myself, as you know, in the site, the sister site, I guess, to the north, we know that these sites are port sites. They were operating from, well, in your case, the sort of Ptolemaic era, 3rd century BC through to 6th century AD, roughly, anyway. And that, you know, they were linked with... obviously the Nile through the desert and then across to India. So they were fairly pivotal in terms of connections. But they're also hellish places to live. They're in the middle of nowhere. Exactly. And that there's all this richness and wealth, not just that indicates trade moving through, but actually people practicing everyday life, but on quite a scale. So how do you read all of this? I mean, all of these, you know, this... dedications and richness and Buddhas and, I mean, connectivity. It's incredible. How do you interpret all of that in terms of the role of this site?
One word, greed.
So nothing's changed then in the last 2,000 years?
No, everybody's... you've lived out there, I've lived out there, between the wind and the sand and the bugs and the snakes and the bad food and the everything. And it wasn't any better. It was probably worse back then, unless you had lots of money. I think, the main attraction is how can I make, money?
Yeah.
And at whatever level you might be, from a stevedore, you know, who otherwise wouldn't have a job, to some wealthy Indian merchants who clearly the ones who had the money to dedicate that statue. I mean, that's imported marble. It's not stone indigenous to Egypt. And that, by the way, I should point this out: all of the stone dedications, whether they're the Hindus or the Hindu deities or the Buddhism, these are all, with the exception of the marble Buddha that I mentioned, all carved in local stone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're stone local to Berenike. So, and we know that there was a sculptural workshop at Berenike that was producing second to third rate stuff.
So do you think, so basically these things were being made locally, but reflecting the beliefs of the people that were living at the site. So they're invested in being there then too. I mean, obviously the greed element is critical to that, but that's how they live their lives subsequently. That's the material that's moving through that they're earning money from. But they're invested in being there and making this a place to live in some degree of luxury, or at least connect with their religions. And that, I mean, that's pretty fascinating in its own right.
Marble, as you know, in Egypt is very, very unusual, especially out in these remote locations. Mm. And while we haven't 100% sourced the marble for a whole bunch of reasons, we're almost 100% certain that it's Proconesian. Yeah. But the current best interpretation of the marble is that it is Proconesian. So then you go, okay, so what's that doing here, and how did it get here? And so here's our current best guess, okay, is that somebody at Berenike, or a group of people, you know, with major money to spend, hired, and it wasn't probably a local guy because the quality is simply too good. So they may have hired somebody from the valley, from the Nile Valley, possibly as far away as Alexandria, and said, okay, look, we need you down here. Can you bring a slab of marble and, you know, do your carving here? We don't know that it was carved at the site. That we don't know. But what we do know is that most Greco-Roman sculptors or Egyptian sculptors would not have had a clue what Buddha looked like. And so the best is you're going to have either a really good drawing, you know, from a three-D view of Buddha, or someone actually describing to the sculptors, he or she is working on it, okay, you need to do this, the eyes need to look like this, here's a halo, there's a bun, long ears, all of that kind of thing. So there, it would have required a lot of interaction between probably the people making the dedication and paying for it and the sculptor who had to carve it.
But that's what I love about archaeology, though, isn't it? Is that when you have an object like that and all of those sort of scenarios that can come into play as to how they got there and why they were there and the significance and importance. And I mean, it's fascinating. There are so many different peoples and religions represented in these port sites. And it's something you always think about, well, what do the ships look like? You know, where did they moor? All of these things that somebody like myself would like to answer. But actually, what it's really about is the people and why they were there and what was driving their ambitions and their greed, as you say. It's really fascinating. So do you have plans to do more? I mean, how, I know you've been in Berenike for a few years now, haven't you?
Yeah, we started in 1994, so 30 years. But, you know, we're planning to continue for as long as possible. Mm. And then when I reach the point where I can't, you know, stand up anymore, I guess, I'll pass it off to somebody else. But I mean, it's an amazing site. I mean, yeah. You know, definitely there's centuries worth, if you excavate it correctly. There are literally centuries worth of seasons to dig there.
And, I mean, we know that it's in the middle of nowhere. It's pretty inaccessible. How do, you know, if somebody listening to this wanted to go and see some of these artifacts, is that feasible? I know you have the storage area that you referred to, but...
Yeah, well, about 3 years ago or so, the military extended its base to include our area, which is sort of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it really does protect it. On the other hand, it makes it less accessible than it was before. It used to be, before they built the wall, that you could stay in one of those fancy hotels just north of Ras Banas, you know, about 40 kilometers away, and you could get a day pass and come down and visit, and we had people who did that. But lately, that seems to be next to impossible to do, which is sort of interesting because on the one hand, the Egyptian authorities are trying to open this up as a tourist area. As you may know, they built the Berenice International Airport.
No.
Which they officially opened, a year and a half ago, but has never had a single flight come into it or go out of it. Okay, so if you try to buy a ticket to fly to or from Berenike, good luck. I mean, they had the whole thing. The plane was driving under the, you know, the fire hoses, and everybody was excited, and nothing has happened. So you have this sort of dichotomy going on. On the one hand, oh, it's a military area, we don't want people here, but then we're going to open this international airport to draw tourists. So well, what is it that you want here?
Yeah.
We have a new area that's very interesting we call the Northern Complex, which we've been finding over the years, and we're going to really concentrate on that this coming season. Is also a religious area. It's a place where the Falcon Shrine was discovered, and that publication appeared in the American Journal of Archaeology back in 2021. We'd excavated that in 2019. Wow. And that also turned up about a dozen or so headless bodies of falcons.
What?
As well as one falcon skeleton with a head. And then a very interesting inscription. It was in a stela, again, an Egyptian style, but with Greek text. And the Greek text said, "It's forbidden to boil the head here."
Sorry, that's just... What's going on in this place? Headless falcons and...
we sort of decided, okay, well, the dozen headless falcons have to have something to do with this inscription, right? So, in other words, there's a lot of material coming out of this Northern Complex area. And so now that the temple's pretty much done, the Isis temple, we want to move most of our operations, not all of them, over to the Northern Complex and continue there and to see what comes up in the future.
Yeah. It really is an incredible sight. But Steve, I mean, you still haven't found me a boat though. Bits of timbers, I know, but I haven't had anything substantial enough yet, unless you're hiding something from me.
No, not hiding anything. The best items we found were back, I believe, in 2010, 2011, when we found those ship timbers and part of the hull, right, made of cedar. That we found in the harbor area, and they were all charred. And of course, we did our best. We did the photos and the drawings, and we actually did surgery on them so that we could see that it was, the mortise and tenon construction and all of that. And we did our best to move them, but it didn't work. And no matter what we conserved the best we could. We tried to move them, and it just disintegrated. We made our best effort. That's not to say, of course, there might not be more out there. And as you know, they did recycle a lot of the ship's timbers into the architecture. And we have a lot of leveling courses in some of our later buildings, that are clearly from dismantled ships, which is typical Egyptian building tradition, right? To dismantle ships and recycle them.
Yeah.
So, we don't know what we're going to find. You never know at this site. It's always a big surprise, but I can tell you we've never had a season that disappointed us.
Right.
There's always been something. And we might dig for weeks and go, well, maybe this is a season we don't get anything, and then bang.
Yeah.
Just when we start to lose hope, Buddha pops up, or or Sebu Mekher pops up, or an inscription with a Blemmy King pops up, or, we just don't know. So, so I think she's paying us back for all the suffering we do in those tents and those windblown, forlorn places with too many flies and those little biting gnats and all the other nasty things that crawl and fly around the site. So,
yeah, you're taking me back to the good old days, Steve. You're taking me back.
And not to mention the great food and the effects that has on everybody, right?
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah. Oh, it's so good to talk to you. Thank you so much. I mean, it's as you say, there's always something really exciting at Berenike. And, I mean, the Buddha and, I mean, just the temple in its own right has just given you so much. And I hope you find a few more headless falcons when you relocate to the northern area. Yes. Anyway, thank you so much. I really appreciate.
Of course, we're very... thankful for the funding that the Honor Frost Foundation has provided over the years. So,
well, it's our pleasure. Wow, that was great. The Red Sea port sites are truly fascinating. I was really lucky, as we mentioned in the interview, to have worked at the site to the north of Berenike, Corsair. And the preservation along this coastline is amazing because it's so dry. So you get organics and these incredible finds that Steve's just told us about from all over the sort of Western Indian Ocean, the Mediterranean. It's this sort of place where people and ideas and goods obviously meet. So really exciting, and thanks very much to Steve. So I hope you enjoyed the latest episode in the Dive and Dig News podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation. Hopefully you'll be tuning in again soon. Take care. Bye.